Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us Anne Maureen Oliver, and she's going to be talking about a book that's just come out called The Road to Martyrs Square, A Journey into the World of the Suicide Bomber. And probably better than any book I've read or anyone I've talked to, this book goes into the mindset of the people living in the Palestinian area and the Gaza Strip, in the Palestinian area and living in Jerusalem itself, their attitude, and of course the various components within the Palestinian movement. Why they want to die, why they are willing to die, why are they willing to give their life to kill Jewish people. It's a tremendous opportunity to read the book, because it's written by a woman who was there, who lived in the Gaza area for a time, who lived in Jerusalem, who lived there. How long were you over there, Anne-Marie?
6 years.
So,
in the area.
And, of course, you spent a lot of time just talking about the graffiti. And you got to know an awful lot of the Palestinians, didn't you?
Yes. I mean, Paul and I, the co-author of the book, Paul Steinberg and I, were there, and we basically talked with anybody who would speak with us, which got us entree into all kinds of worlds. You know, Stanley, we didn't go there to write a book on suicide bombers. We were there before the advent of the Intifada, and certainly before the advent of suicide bombers. So I think this is one thing that really differentiates our book from other books out there, the sheer fact that we didn't go there to write a book about suicide bombers.
In fact, you went there to teach, didn't you? To teach.
Well, yes. A guy was starting a school in the Gaza Strip, and he was something of a luthmensch. He's actually a very close friend of ours, a blind man and a musician. And the school just never materialized. So we began to just, like I said, talk to anybody who would talk with us, and we were particularly interested in Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, as it's called, which we kind of tracked from the very beginnings. In fact, the first part of the book is something of an introduction to Gaza, and it's also something of a political biography of the leader of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmad Yassin, who was assassinated fairly recently by the Israelis. And so, you know, we started tracking Hamas and talking with anybody who would talk with us. And you mentioned the graffiti. You know, people here in America, they might get the wrong idea when they hear graffiti. You know, you were in the middle of a war, the middle of a revolution, and you were taking pictures of graffiti. You have to understand that graffiti covered every square inch of the walls. It was even written on cactuses and stones and cars. It was everywhere.
Yeah, but, of course, it reflected the feelings of the people. It's, these people were filled with anger and hatred and frustration, and really, that's really what you're trying to bring out, isn't it?
Well, it's a study of scripts, and by that we mean, you know, the filmic metaphor, a kind of ready-made program for thought, behavior, and action, you know, and scripts, as we know, are particularly important to adolescents, and these were very adolescent scripts. And so, you know, when people are uncertain as to what to do, they turn to scripts. At the beginning of Intifada, people had no idea what was an Intifada. What were they expected to do?
Well, hold up.
Graffiti told them what to do.
Hold that thought here for just a moment.
Sure.
We'll be back in just a moment as we bring some other stations on. We lose some stations, and then shortly we'll have everybody back together to hear the story of the road to Martyr Square. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Anne Marie Oliver, who, with a friend, lived over in the Palestinian section of the Holy Land for, what, 6 or 8 years, was it?
6 years.
For 6 years. And, of course, they were there before the Infidada, before the this movement took hold. And, of course, she takes you into the background of the various movements. There wasn't one movement. There were several movements there, and there were different leaders. There was, of course, the Hamas, which was basically Islamic fundamentalism. And then there were the sort of the nationalists behind Arafat, and then a conflict between the two groups. And as you pointed out in one place, which I thought was fascinating, there are many people there that actually believe that the Israelis actually helped to fund Hamas initially. Is that true?
Yes, that is true. I mean, the Israelis saw Hamas as, you know, a counter movement to Fatah, their longtime enemy, the nationalist. And so they, you know, at the very least, they turned a blind eye to the activities of, you know, the early leaders of Hamas and the precursors of Hamas. I mean, you know, Hamas was created in 1988 or so, at least that's when their Mithaq or covenant was released, but it goes back to a very old organization in the Arab world, which was founded by a man in Egypt called Hassan al-Banna. This goes back to, say, the late 20s. So, you know, the Hamas is not a new movement. It's simply the Palestinian wing of the Muslim Brotherhood.
And, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood was really the one organization that was really coordinating this whole radical Islamic movement, other than, of course, the Wahhabi movement within that was within Saudi Arabia. But the Muslim Brotherhood really had spread out, but it never really had much strength up until about, what, the 1980s.
In Palestine, yes, the late 80s, they created Hamas as the so-called spearhead of Islam in the territories, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And they produced in I think it was August 1988, a covenant for the movement. What's interesting about this covenant is it provided something that really Fatah and the nationalist groups, like the kind of Marxist groups, PFLP and the DFLP, did something these groups had not done. What it did is it provided people with a complete program for life. If you look at the Mithaq, it outlines everything from blue jeans to jihad, you know, the role of women in the quote, liberation battle, unquote, to the last days.
And so
every single aspect of life is taking care of you. And that's why we talk about scripts, you know, in the book, and the importance of scripts in determining thought and action in life.
Well, I think what it was so interesting to me is that the nationalists were Marxist, communists, and just Palestinian nationalists, but hold that thought, we'll be with you in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Anne Marie Oliver, and we're talking about her book that she wrote along with Paul Steinberg entitled The Road to Martyrs Square. The Road to Martyrs Square. It is a fascinating analysis of what goes on in Palestine, and we're talking about, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood had been a radical Islamic movement going back to the Muslim Brotherhood in about 1928 in Egypt, but suddenly it comes into the Palestinian area, and before that you had your nationalist movement, your Palestinian liberation movement. But now, starting about 1988, you have a new movement. And a new movement with a religious fervor that had never been there before, and that would call upon people to kill themselves and to send their children to be killed and to train them to be killed and to die. And this put a whole different complexion on the movement, didn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, you know, you had kind of precursors to this and the idea of a fedayi, a self-sacrificer in the nationalist movement. So it wasn't completely unheard of. In the case of suicide bombers, what changed is that you went out and you knew you were going to die, and you were prepared to die. And so, you know, there are many commonly cited motivations for suicide bombers. There's the occupation, there's a grievance, there's revenge, there's sacrifice, there's glory, nationalism, power, paradise, money. I think a large number of these ingredients had to be there for the idea of a suicide bomber to take hold. And I think probably one of the most important motivations is glory. Every adolescent wants to be a hero. And the scripts that are offered up to you to be a hero are ones of violent death and martyrdom and jihad. You're going to seize on those. And that's in fact one of our major ideas in this book, is that, you know, these scripts did not just appear during the Intifada. They're actually very, very old. They go back to the Palestinian revolts of 36, 1948, the 60s. Some of them go back to the Ottoman Empire. Some of them, we have graffiti in our collection that are hundreds of years old. What adolescents and youth did during Intifada is they took these slogans and these scripts that have been around, for, like I said, sometimes hundreds of years, and they literalized them. And, you know, literalism is a very powerful, subversive strategy. And by literalism, you know, I'm from the South. So much of language is metaphoric. When people take what should be metaphoric and they literalize it, then there are all kinds of things that go into play. You know, if we're sitting eating dinner and there's a plate of chicken between us and there's one piece of chicken left on the plate, and I say, you know, your name is on it. You say, oh, no, you must have it. And I take the piece of chicken without another word. This is kind of literalism of the sort I'm talking about. I've actually broken the rules here because this should really go on, this back and forth, until we say, why don't we have it, right? So this is what we mean by literalism. Every religion has within it the possibility for violence. Every person has the potentiality for violence. Every culture has a high potentiality for violence. And this is what has to be fought against rather than given into. These scripts allowed youth to not only give in to violence, but to actualize it in the real world and thus become heroes through this very process of literalization.
And, of course, as you point out, this was not simply boys. This was even girls. They were becoming, what a wonderful way to become a martyr and to live on, because you would be honored and the people would continue talking about you. And you were a very, very special person if you died killing Jews.
Yes, you had embodied the whole idea of sacrifice, either for the homeland or for Allah or for both. Actually, it came more and more to that point. I don't think you can overestimate here what we can call the movie star factor. You were a suicide bomber in Palestinian society. You were something of a movie star, if not a sex symbol. And this aspect of glory and self-mythologization and collective mythologization was central, quite central.
Well, now, Chris, you had an opportunity to talk to an awful lot of Palestinians. Did you ever talk to any of the suicide bombers?
Well, actually, in part three of the book, we focus on one cell of Hamas suicide bombers, three guys who are going to go out and blow up an Israeli bus, which is capable of holding, you know, 80 people. And
they want to kill as many as possible or maim them.
Yes, the whole idea is not, you know, people call suicide bombers, and we use the term in the book, but there's a huge homicidal element here, because, as you know, suicide is forbidden, strictly forbidden in Islam. You are not to bring destruction upon yourself by your own hand. And so this stricture, I think, was gotten around to some degree by the fact that you were to go out and you were to take with you into death as many of the enemy as possible. And this is what these people did. That's getting around, I think, the stricture against suicide. So there, you know, there's a strong homicidal element here, which can't be divorced from the suicidal element.
But there's this total lack of concern for your own life. I mean, this is what's so hard for the average American living, you know, in our cloistered society to grasp, is that these people really want to die. They're looking forward to death. This, of course, is going to take them immediately to paradise. They're convinced.
Right. Well, I mean, the whole process, as would be apropos for adolescents, was erotized. Death was erotized. You know, the guy with whom we spoke who survived the suicide bombing, the last night these guys spent together, they talked about nothing but the virgins of paradise. So the whole process was erotized. The martyr was presented as a bridegroom. Upon his death, once arriving in paradise, he would receive 72 virgins. There were all the old mourning and martyrdom songs, which are kind of highly erotic in nature anyway. These were applied to the martyr.
I'm going to go to the hospital. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.